Welcome to Farce Perspective, a podcast about the last 50 years of comedy. On key anniversaries, we look back and ask, what was innovative material then? What continues to be successful now? And what have people thought about it along the way?
I'm Ben.
I'm Pete.
And welcome back to The Henson Perspective, where today we're talking about the 45th anniversary of the Milton Berle episode, which aired on this date, November 11th, 1977 in New York City. It was the third production episode, but it's airing ninth.
Correct.
Because this is the beginning of a new quartet of episodes as Pete and I go head-to-head, one-to-one on having achieved and won through trivia points a Lego Muppet minifig. And now the slate is clean, and whoever does well on today's trivia questions will inch closer to breaking the tie.
Except you can't earn points on today's episode.
No. Only you can earn points on today's episode.
Right.
Only I can prevent you from earning points on today's episode.
Is this the way it's going to be from now on?
No. No. I wrote the questions as I always do, just because I found them interesting, but there will be a twist.
Ooh, talk about a little twist.
Talk about a little twist that we will get to once the trivia comes around. But we're not doing trivia and the guest star to start the episode.
Yes, we're going to start with the bits that don't directly tie into the guest star or the runner, because something that happens in one of those sections that is then referred to in it. So it makes more sense to talk about those bits first, and then we'll do the trivia, do the
guest and backstage segments that connect to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll wrap up, as we always do, by talking about statistics and our five favorite moments in the episode. So let's begin, therefore, with the first segment that has nothing to do with Milton Berle, which is the first song that Curtin...
No. The opening.
Well...
The credits.
I suppose we can talk about the two things that happen in the credits.
You just don't like talking about either the cold open or the opening.
I was thinking that because we weren't going to talk about the cold open, which led into the opening.
But you also just don't like talking about either of those two things. Because when we start with the guest, you regularly just pass over both of those things.
Yeah. I think of the opening as guest related when I remember it. If you would prefer to talk about the opening, yes. As usual, we have two lay-in segments in the opening. We have a Statler and Waldorf joke, and we have a Gonzo moment. And the Statler and Waldorf joke is that...
Statler says, another show, another headache.
And Gonzo, upon blowing into the trumpet in the O, sprays water out in a cascading warbling noise.
See, the reason I wanted to talk about this is because this is the first Gonzo bit of the season that I've enjoyed and thought was fun and good. It's not just smoke of a different color coming out. And Gonzo also makes a face while the water is coming out. Like, this isn't supposed to be happening. So that's why I wanted to talk about it, because it's very good.
After that, Kermit comes out in front of the curtain to provide context and introduce the guest, and then to introduce the first number, which is referred to on the Muppet fandom page as Ugly Song. This is because this doesn't have necessarily a formal title, as it's one of a number of songs that the Muppet Show used that was written by Paul Tracy. Pete, you remember that name?
I've heard it before, because I'm sure you've said it to me before. Is he the music supervisor?
No, okay. But it is that other piece of Inside Baseball where... there was a writer who wrote a couple of songs and then met with Jim in order to specifically commission music for the show, and then nothing came out of that commission. There are, if I recall correctly, four of his songs that are used on the show, but he doesn't have a particularly impactful larger profile as a songwriter. He did, however, previously write, or will write in terms of production order, in the Madeline Kahn episode in 209, he writes Gonzo's song about dreaming in stars that he sings
right
when she comes down the stairs. What's referred to as the wishing song. This is the ugly song. That is the wishing song. The man clearly has a gift.
Or he just doesn't like titles.
Or because these aren't necessarily
songs
that existed out there in the world, they're referred to by their generic purpose in the fandom.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a comic song where a bunch of grotesque creatures, objects, monsters, and animals talk about how ugly they are, but that's okay, because beautiful's out, ugly's in. The first verse focuses on an alligator.
Crocodile? That's what it's listed as being in the Wikia.
I'll check the lyrics, but I wrote down alligator pretty specifically. I don't think my handwriting is quite that bad, but the transcript, much like the subtitles of the DVDs, doesn't list the lyrics.
Hmm.
And so while you're right that the fandom calls it a crocodile, we will have a drop-in of the lyrics here to prove which of us is correct.
Take the case of our friend the crocodile. His bite is much worse than his bark. In fact, his behavior is juvenile.
Infantile!
I hope that it doesn't... That it never refers to either one directly.
The second verse is about a warthog, and the third verse is about sort of reclaiming the concept of if you're ugly, there's no need to try and avoid that.
And I will say that while I appreciate the message, three verses, too many verses. This went on way too long.
The first two verses felt very focused in that there was, it's not unlike Swinging on a Star, where each verse is, here's an animal, here's why this animal represents a certain kind of human behavior, and we can make a joke about it, and then we go back to the chorus. The third verse doesn't have that structure. And so not only does it feel like it's deviating from the joke, it also is a little moralistic, and do I need that in my comic songs?
I do need it in my Comic Sans.
You need morals in your Comic Sans?
Yeah, all fonts should have a moral to them.
Well, the moral of Comic Sans is that it's easy to read.
It's true.
And therefore helpful with certain people who have linguistic disabilities. And despite the fact that it's reviled by most of the world, it actually does have a useful structural piece to it. But I would say Comic Sans... is ugly, it's ugly as sin.
Oh, see, I was going to say, these Muppets must be represented by Wingdings.
Because?
They're ugly. They're ugly as sin. No one wants to look at them. Which isn't true, because the Warthog is excellent.
And the collection of Muppets that is the series of monsters in this sketch is fun.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen a couple of them for a while. And I feel like the choice of the actors to play them is also unusual. Jim Henson's playing a blue Frackle and doing it in a way that I don't normally associate with his kind of performance.
Except for the voice. I almost had a problem with it. Mm. It was so Jim.
He's a useful and happy reptile.
I'll gobble up anyone left lying round, and that gives me my permanent smile.
Frank plays the alligator?
Crocodile.
And he's doing something different as well. Like, you may say that it's not far enough away from Jim's normal persona that therefore it was distracting for you, but I think he's trying to do a thing, and I think Frank is as well. They're both trying to get away from what they normally do in terms of their voices.
Mm-hmm. I did also like the transitions between the verses.
Mm,
how
yes.
In every one, it was the going into the mouth, like they'd either open their mouth and try and eat the camera or be holding a note and the camera would zoom in.
Yeah, basically creates a full wipe.
Very much appreciated that. Then we have our first Statler and Waldorf segment where there's something wrong with Waldorf's hearing aid and then he accidentally knocks it off a ledge.
At which point Statler says, well, that's why it's not working. It's too far away.
And then Waldorf winds up and hits Statler, giving him Scrunchy Face.
We haven't seen Scrunchy Face in a while.
We have not. I was surprised that this was the joke they went with. Because as soon as he said there's something wrong with his hearing aid, I was fully expecting him to say, I can hear too well with it.
Huh.
Making a...
Oh, I wish it wasn't working so that I couldn't hear what was going on stage.
Yeah, and that wasn't what they did.
Well, I also didn't necessarily think that the Statler and Waldorf opening line was very good. Another show, another headache. It is almost beat for beat how the Muffaphones talked when they walked on to be hit.
That's true.
It doesn't have that ring of the kind of irritation that Statler and Waldorf bring to their bits.
I also like it more when, even though they're not singing along, when whatever they say works with the rhythm.
Yes.
And this didn't work with the rhythm. Then we have our first backstage moment, so we will come back to that later.
Backstage moment leads into our first guest star spot, which is substantial, and after which there is a Muppet News Flash, Dateline London.
Yeah, this is more of a traditional season one style Muppet News Flash, where it's not something that's happening in the studio or to the newsman. He's just reading a news story.
The will of the late Mary Crandall is being read and is contested between her son Charles and her cat Cutie Pie. The eventual turn of the sketch is that the estate that they're fighting over is a collection of 10,000 rubber mice, which Charles is able to successfully win.
It's interesting. We, or I, often joke about, give me 45 years and I'll punch up any joke.
Yeah.
We haven't yet had a moment until now where the show is oddly prescient.
Okay.
Because in the news recently, there's been a man named Charles who's come into a very large inheritance.
Yeah, but he was fighting it out with corgis, not with a cat.
So it's close.
It's close.
They almost got it right.
After that, we have Pigs in Space. And this is the first production Pigs in Space. And you can instantly tell because the theme song is different. And the text, the voiceover, the sound effects, everything is slightly off.
And now, Pigs in Space!
Also, in the intros, they kind of use vocab, but they also don't use vocab. No, they definitely introduce the characters in this one.
The line for Link Hogthrob is that he is intrepid and well-fed. His first mate and second in command, the very cute and very dangerous Miss Piggy. It's basically a
extremely
bio.
Dangerous.
I beg your pardon. So, yeah, it's like a mini bio as opposed to just a one-word bit that they're assigning.
Ben, don't forget the super brain behind this whole ghastly mistake.
Right.
The inexplicable Dr. Julius Strangepork.
I'm pretty sure the inexplicable Dr. Strangepork is a word that they've used in previous subsequent Pigs in Space.
Which also works with the outro for this episode, too.
Yes, it does. But I did like the line, this whole ghastly mistake, because it implies that, you know, it has that 3-hour tour quality to Pigs in Space. That's, you know, that they're, where Star Trek, they're on a 5-year mission to explore new worlds. It's the Star Trek Voyager.
Sure. I believe you. But the sketch begins after the intro with a strange light flashing that's coming straight for the Swine Trek.
They're trying to use their various instruments to determine what it is. Piggy puts forward that it seems like it's a light on a motorcycle.
Mm-hmm.
But no, it can't be that. It's a mysterious celestial object.
Strangepork estimates that there's 17 hours until collision, and then moments later goes, sorry, 17 hours was a bit long. It's 17 seconds.
And I did spend a little bit thinking, because time is not decimal, that can't be like, oh, I didn't carry a decimal point. The 60s-ness, the weird we don't have a consistent base for measuring time-ness of it means they couldn't have just moved a point and gotten the wrong number. So it was fine as a punchline, but mathematically, statistically speaking.
Not for that reason, because time is a decimal, or can be a decimal. It could be converted into a decimal. I do it every week. For example, the intro to Pigs in Space was 0.57 seconds long. Minutes long. Damn.
Well done, Julius. After they realize that it's only 17 seconds away, it's then revealed that it's Gonzo on a motorcycle heading straight for them.
Piggy was right all along.
As Link decides that he's going to go off and do other things now that he's been disproven.
Or they've avoided the collision, so maybe he's just like, all right, crisis averted, I'm going to go lay down now.
Yeah, it didn't feel like that.
Yeah, I know.
That wasn't the vibe.
Nope.
He gets into the lift and or transporter area to the side of the stage and...
Yeah, wherever that goes.
We haven't seen. We know that there are doors on either side of the swine trick. An ironing board was brought in from one side.
Mm-hmm.
At which point the doors close on his nose.
Which Piggy loves. Also, I know I ask this a lot. Does that count as a hit?
Oh, recently we've talked about... whether or not you can have a hit without intent.
Mm-hmm.
Because when Piggy walked through the hospital doors into Vet's hospital and they swung shut and smacked her from behind, we were talking about the idea that we were going to count that as a hit, but normally we wouldn't because it wasn't something that happened to her because somebody did something.
Right.
So the doors closing on his nose...
caused him pain,
but nobody like pulled a lever in order for it to happen, which is something that will definitely happen in future Pigs in Space.
So not a hit.
I think not, but at the same time, I did want to point out, we are being inconsistent by not calling this a hit.
Hey, as long as we're consistently inconsistent, I'm fine with it.
We're definitely consistently inconsistent.
Good. And then, yeah, the last announcer outro is tune in next week for last week's chapter of Pigs in Space, which I loved knowing that this was the first one that's ever happened.
Right.
So there was none before. Then we have a few more runners and guest segments.
Which lead to the fade to black for the ad break. We come back from the UK spot.
Yeah, normally we would talk about the UK spot here, but the UK spot is kind of linked to... the previous guest spot. So we'll come back and discuss that.
And then we have a continued backstage bit. And then Kermit comes out in front of the curtain to introduce the act.
And now, straight from a 3-month engagement at the Desert Springs, Vermont Humane Society.
Yeah, I have no idea what any of these words mean together. Individually, get it all.
We have Zelda Rose and her singing owl doing Who.
Who? Spoon my heart away. Ooh. Makes me dream all day.
Which reminded me exactly of a bit that we saw a few weeks ago with Mary Louise and her friend in the Steve Martin episode, because it's pretty much the same thing.
Except she's not getting yoinked off stage.
Right.
And as we talked about then, that was much like Sam the Eagle popping in to say, Willow, tit, Willow, tit, Willow. It's the same structure of one person providing a sound effect while somebody else does 85% of the rest of the lyrics.
Yeah.
In this regard, there is a song as written by Kern and Hammerstein in 1925 for the musical Sonny that's called Who. And whenever the lyric Who would have been sung by the person who was singing the song, in this case, Zelda Rose's owl wakes up and sings the lyric.
Ben, did this owl look like anything in particular to you?
Yes, I thought it looked a lot like Bubo from Clash of the Titans, but that came out in 1981.
Mm.
The way in which the body was solid and the eyes and wings would flap up in a mechanical way, that's what it reminded me of, I thought, until I then checked out the reference to be able to get that date. So no, I think you're thinking it looks like...
Get it?
A Furby.
Yeah, sure does. Again, came out after Bubo did. But it looks exactly like a Furby. I had references ready on my phone if you did not know.
I mean, surely all of us easily recognize and remember a Furby after the massive global success of Uncut Gems.
True, that's right. Oh man, I want that.
You want
I'm
that?
Not a necklace guy.
But you want a bling Furby?
I want a real...
There are lots of blingy Furbies out there since that movie came out.
Yeah, I don't want those.
Okay.
I want that one.
You want the real one.
Yeah, no cheapskate. If I'm going to be a necklace guy,
Peter,
I'm going to be
a
necklace guy.
You are very much a cheapskate.
Right.
But
I'm no cheapskate.
In this hypothetical, becoming a necklace guy, that's also going to transform your character.
Exactly. I can't have that necklace turning my skin green. I gotta have that real Furby bling.
You wouldn't like it when my intercostal clavicle is angry.
No. Not at all. Also, before we move on, we talked about this being similar to the Steve Martin bit with Mary Louise.
Yep.
This was indirectly an audition in itself.
Yeah, I saw the note about this on the fandom page, but why don't you go ahead and give our listeners the details there?
So after Aaron Oscar left after season one, they tried out a few different female Muppeteers to replace her in season two. It ended up going to Louise Gold, but this was production episode 3, so before Louise Gold got the job, a woman named Abby Hadfield was auditioning, and in this episode she played one of the Green Frackles in The Ugly Song and Zelda Rose in this. So it's also interesting to me that this episode was produced first. Later they do the Steve Martin thing. Basically do the same idea in that in an audition that she then auditioned for using the same bit.
I understand why somebody would find that interesting. I think it's interesting that a person who's trying to get a job and doesn't get that job has her work product included in a production episode.
I'm not credited for it.
Correct. I mean, it takes forever for Louise Gold to get credited.
A whole season.
The very idea that this woman performs this and it's broadcast, but she doesn't get credit and she isn't hired, I find that to be labor suspicious.
I mean, I'm sure she was still compensated for
her
work.
I'm sure she was too, but the Muppet Chickens have a better union than women do.
Well, it is 1977, Ben.
Yeah, that's problematic on lots of levels.
The ERA hadn't passed yet, or still.
I'm just saying. Sorry, guys, but history is not in your favor in this particular moment that you were like, yeah, we will take your labor, and we will continue to use it, and maybe you'll get residuals, but maybe not, because your name's nowhere in the credits.
Yeah, almost certainly no residuals.
No good.
Very bad. Don't do it. And then the last thing we have to talk about before looping back around is the closing Statler and Waldorf bit.
And this is a callback to the hearing aid, wherein Waldorf says, well, I finally got the hearing aid up and running.
Statler says, speak up, my hearing aid's not working, which, good joke, but also, Waldorf's hearing aid is like a box that he has a string attached to it and his ear.
It's the classic David Lynch in Twin Peaks external pocket hearing aid.
Yeah, and Statler has no such device attached to him.
He is decades ahead of the kind of miniaturization and flesh colored that you're able to get.
Another prescient moment, since just weeks ago, hearing aids went over the counter.
It's amazing. It's amazing that these two old men have such incredibly different healthcare. Yeah, I agree with you that if you pay too much attention, you might be like, I should be able to see Statler's hearing aid. But luckily, it then cuts right to Zoot and the orchestra pit, and we're done with the episode.
But we're not done with this episode.
That's right. Because in order to talk about the rest of the episode, which we blithely skipped over in order to talk about those few bits, first I have to ask Pete 5 trivia questions about this week's special guest star, Milton Berle. Milton Berle was born July 2nd, 1908, to Mr. and Mrs. Mo Berlinger. His name was Mendel Berlinger, and while he took the stage name of Milton Berle, he never legally changed his name.
Interesting.
And continued to be Mendel to friends and acquaintances throughout his life. While he was famously known as Mr. Television and famously called Uncle Milty, that was not his name at all. At least when he's being interviewed in a book that we'll talk about over the course of the trivia questions, he says, you know, Mr. Burl, it's very nice to meet you. And he says, right off the bat, please call me Mendel.
I wonder if people called him Uncle Mendy.
I do not have that information. There is an enormous amount of information out there on Milton Berle, who had been performing as Milton Berle for almost 50 years before he appeared on this show, but had a legendary childhood performance before that, has appeared in over 20 silent films between the ages of 5 and 12, according to his recollection.
Wow.
Before then, in 1920, appearing in his first stage role and then having a massively popular television show in 1948. All of that is prelude to the following questions. Question number one. In the introduction to Burl's 1945 collection of jokes and routines, Out of My Trunk, Burl claims to have indexed 2,500,000 jokes from his career that far. When interviewed by Larry Wilde in the 2000 book Great Comedians Talk About Comedy, Burl says that he has an agreement with the Library of Congress to collect his papers after his death. He continued to collect and cross-reference jokes during his whole life, and at that point, in the year 2000, he states that he had how many jokes collected by that point? A. 4 million. B. 4.7 million. Or C. 6 million.
B.
No, 4 million was the number that he stated.
Figured he had to slow down at some point.
Question number two. Burl was described in his biographical context for the Library of Congress collection as, quote, a prolific writer. But most of his published work are collections of jokes from his archives. He wrote with Haskell Frankel an autobiography in 1974, which begins in an unusual way. Instead of talking about a major transitional point in his career or how his parents met, more traditional ways of opening an autobiography, he describes reminiscing about a woman that he had an affair with when he was 30, who became pregnant and then married another man and convinced that man that he was the father. What does Wikipedia have to say about this story? A. The story is told in conjunction with Burl's exploits as a legendary, well-hung swordsman, and it is heavily speculated that the woman was Mary Pickford, who just became divorced from Douglas Fairbanks after they founded United Artists. B. Wikipedia spends most of its entry on Burl challenging assertions that he made about his career over time, including the story that over a million TV sets were sold in the U.S. in 1949 because of the popularity of his TV show. The chapter of his autobiography is summarized briefly and then closes with an elegant citation needed following the claim. C. Burl tells the story on the Mike Douglas Show in 1974 and takes offense at the way fellow guest Richard Pryor responded to the story as he laughed and Burl was severely unimpressed, challenging his cavalier response at something that he considered to be heartfelt and melodramatic.
When you asked that question, my first instinct before hearing any of that was, citation needed. I want to go with C. I'm going to go with B.
C. I have zero information as to who the person is. He protects her identity and the identity of her husband. It is fascinatingly written. And then, chapter two, he goes to, my parents met. It's such a bizarre opening to a book. And the fact that he was then going on talk shows and touring with this opening chapter as a way to get people to read it says something about where he was in his life at this time in terms of how he's defining his narrative to his legacy. Question number three. According to Wikipedia, Burl had a reputation for taking command of writers' rooms for shows he appeared on. So much so that his one appearance on Saturday Night Live in 1979 was such a clash of styles and personalities that Lorne prevented that episode from ever appearing in reruns until 2003. Joseph A. Bailey has a whole chapter on working with Burl in Memoirs of a Muppet Writer. How does he characterize Burl's participation in writing the show? A. Condescending. Burl was teaching a course on comedy and comedy writing at UCLA at the time, and he expected the Muppet writers to learn at his feet like he was the master. B. Paternal. Burl was effusive about his long history of comedy in vaudeville, and Henson and Jewell were both fascinated with comedic tradition and wanted to hear as many stories about the old days as possible. C. Meticulous. Burl came prepared with about 20 minutes of heckler jokes for the staff to winnow down to what was best and most appropriate for the sketch. And he had detailed notes for timing and delivery of punchlines, editing, and camera work.
Just like the last question, who would like to be? C comes in there and makes you want to go with it. But I'm going to stick to my guts and go with B again.
You should listen to that second voice. Second thought, best thought. According to Bailey, he had 20 minutes of heckler jokes and a stack of cards that he then just read off all of them in a row. Jerry Jewell transcribed this as it was happening, and about a third of the chapter on Burl is recounting all the other jokes that could have been in his bit with Statler and Waldorf. But also, Bailey has nothing but incredible respect for how good Burl is at being somebody who understands and thinks about comedy structurally, and as somebody who grew up doing comedy on television with an awareness of how live comedy and television comedy are very different, and doing comedy with a laugh track is its own particular beast. And so Burl was well versed in getting reactions when literally he was performing to silence.
Yeah, I can tell all of those things just from watching this episode.
Yeah, and Bailey was really impressed with that.
I'm just glad it wasn't A, because A would have bummed me out if that was the answer.
Question number 4. A surprising number of Muppet Show guest stars appeared in the 1960s Batman television show, including Milton Berle. For example, Ethel Merman plays a gambling crime boss named Lola Lasagna. Milton Berle, in his 2 episodes, plays Louis the Lilac, and he actually plays it in conjunction with another Muppet guest star. Who was it? A. Season 3 guest Liberace plays the Rainbow Raider in a disco ball costumed color-based villain, and Louis the Lilac is one of his Spectrum henchmen, along with Victor Borgia as, in a weird nominal twist, Milton Vermilion. B. Louis is a Poison Ivy-esque villain with henchmen of his own. Technically, he appears in the episode with Vincent Price because there's a preview at the end of the next episode where Price appears as Egghead. Otherwise, there's no crossover. Or C. Trick question. Louis the Lilac is one of Poison Ivy's henchmen in an episode of Wonder Woman with Linda Carter, who guest stars on The Muppet Show in season 4.
I'm going against my first instinct this time and going with A.
No, Liberace plays a criminal called Fingers and does not interact with Louis the Lilac. B is true.
The time I go against B.
As always, we end my trivia segments with a look at 6 degrees of Jim Henson, or The Henson Connection, where I look at Milton Berle's top 4 on IMDb, and Pete has to try and connect Milton Berle to Jim Henson based on those films. Pete, Milton Berle's top 4 on IMDb are It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, starring Ethel Merman, Mickey Rooney, Jonathan Winters, and Spencer Tracy. So if you can remember what you learned from Ethel Merman, you'll have that. The Milton Berle Show, which is a television show and doesn't count, and also has people you've probably never heard of, including Arnold Stang and Ruth Gilbert. The Loved One from 1965, featuring Liberace, John Gielgud, James Coburn, Rod Steiger, and, again, Jonathan Winters. And The Muppet Movie from 1979, featuring Jim Henson, Frank Oz, Dave Goles, Jerry Nelson, and Richard Hunt. So here's the aforementioned twist, Pete.
Yeah, I can't use it?
here's what you can do. There are 6 guest stars in the Muppet movie from season 2 of The Muppet Show, 3 of whom have already appeared in our show. If you can remember those 3, or guess any 3 out of the 5, or the previous guest from season 1 that appeared on it, or the guest from season 5 that appears on it, if you can name 3 out of those 8 names, you get the prize.
Okay.
Or you can connect through
Mad World
or Loved One.
Okay.
You have 60 seconds to pursue either one of those strategies, starting now.
Ben, Mel Brooks is in Mad World.
No.
No? Okay. So, Steve Martin, Dom DeLuise. Uh-oh.
2 more that we've talked about so far this season already.
Right, but I'm trying not to look at notes either. I'm trying to do this honestly.
And you have 30 seconds left.
Oh no.
1 more name. All you have to do is remember people who have appeared
yep.
in the
Can I just list them off?
You can try.
Madeline Kahn.
But you're going to have to pick one.
Yeah. Oh, so I do have to pick one. Okay. Milton Berle doesn't count.
10 seconds.
Milton Berle doesn't count, right? Yeah. Okay. Oh, no. Who else have we seen? Oh, boy. Oh, no.
Time.
Oh, no.
The other 2 that we've talked about on the show so far were Edgar Bergen and Madeline Kahn.
Oh, no!
Also appearing in season 2 that appear in the Muppet movie are Cloris Leachman and Bob Hope. Paul Williams from season 1 appeared in the Muppet Show. And James Coburn appears in the Muppet movie, who also is in The Loved One.
Oh, that's fun.
Which I said earlier.
Yeah.
Because I'm always doing somebody to Audrey Hepburn, to James Coburn, and Sherrod to the Muppet movie.
I have no recollection of that. I've never heard those words before in my life. Well, that's a big fat 0 for old Petey Pants. I hate you. Well played.
Milton Berle, as I mentioned, is legendarily given credit for the explosion of domestic television ownership in the United States. The ownership of TV went from 1 million of the U.S. population to 2 million in a year. And it's generally considered to be the case that this is because people wanted to be able to tune into his variety show. So that is where he gets the nickname of Mr. Television.
Interesting.
So in addition to having a massive legendary collection of punchlines and joke setups that he archived and maintained and could recall fairly well, he tells a very good story twice, both in the chapter on the discussion of comedy and to Bailey in my Memoirs of a Muppet Writer, about the fact that he would start a stand-up act with 3 jokes, floaters, he called them, to gauge, is this a highbrow audience, a lowbrow audience, or a hipster audience? Depending on how they laughed at those jokes, he would then go into his next half hour of A, B, or C material. So he had 3 sets memorized and would pick one based on his intro and how people responded to it.
That's fascinating.
So he not only had a powerful mind, he was committed to making sure that his audience enjoyed themselves and that his material wasn't going to alienate them. And he has some pretty potent things to say about comics that are convinced that their material is good, regardless of whether the audience likes it.
I agree and don't agree with that, but I appreciate his commitment to making sure that they, but also, to counteract what I have a quibble with, he is doing the highest level of whatever set he's choosing to do.
Mm.
So he's still performing the highest level of his art to whichever audience he then deems it to be.
Right.
Versus someone
else. He's not saying, oh, this is an audience that doesn't deserve good entertainment.
Right.
He's still bringing what he considers to be the best bits for whatever the sensibility of the people in front of him is.
Yeah. But you can't expect every comedian to have three sets ready to go at any given time.
So let's talk about the Milton Berle segments. And the backstage segments largely revolve around Fozzie, professional comic, being scared to meet one of his idols, Milton Berle. And right. So
they say never meet your heroes.
They do say that. So Fozzie is taking that to heart and spending most of the backstage bits trying desperately not to meet Milton. So we'll talk about Milton. We'll talk about Milton avoidance.
Just like we started this episode. We started this episode avoiding him.
It's true. But he was, like Thanos, inevitable.
Unavoidable.
So in the opening in the dressing room, Scooter comes in and says, 20 seconds to curtain. Stand by for makeup. How's the time check on that?
The cut to curtain is 15 seconds, and Scooter says 20 seconds to curtains roughly 3 seconds in. So they're way off on this one.
Stand by for makeup means that Burl is smacked with a giant powder puff and stands there looking dazed and a little put out.
This might be the earliest hit of an episode we've ever seen, too. I had a sense memory watching this segment.
Yeah.
Was standby for makeup a running bit we did as kids?
I don't recall it.
Because the way Timmy Monster shouts makeup and then hits him unlocked something for me that I don't know what it is. It was just so familiar that I feel like that was one of our family bits or something, which I can't imagine what it would be unless we hit each other with a pillow or something, like stand by for me and then whack with a pillow. But for some reason, that just feels like something we A, would have done, or B, did do.
I can see us doing the bit in terms of da-da-da-da reference, wham. Like, that feels like our family.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine it was makeup, though.
But the way Timmy says makeup, yeah. I would love for you to drop it in right now.
Stand by for makeup!
Stand by for what?
Makeup!
It's just so familiar to me, and I don't know why, because, as I've said before, I don't think I've seen any of these episodes before.
So, who normally plays Timmy Monster?
Performer various.
In this episode, it's Dave.
Okay.
And I was thinking about the previous occurrences of Timmy Monster that we saw. When he was dancing with Bernadette Peters, he's silent. When he's standing on Nancy Walker, he's silent.
Mm-hmm.
So this was the first time we, I think, have heard Timmy Monster. And I was surprised by the way in which he yells makeup. It was a very particular voice. And I was a little surprised it ended up being Dave, just because I couldn't place who it was at the time. Also, when Timmy Monster is dancing with Bernadette, he has no fangs. He just has a big lower lip.
Mm-hmm.
But here in this segment, in an episode that appears before, he has jutting fangs coming up from his mouth. These fangs then disappear for several episodes and then will come back at the end of the season.
Hmm.
Timmy Monster is, I think, defined by various. Joseph Bailey wants to point out that this is actually Milton adapting a joke that he did regularly on his television show.
Hmm.
In that show, when somebody would have a fight, Milton would say, "Oh, come on, why don't you two kids kiss and make up?" At which point somebody would run in from the wings yelling, "Make up!" and hit him with a powder puff. And so that is a bit that they are then adapting for this. But as Bailey points out, and as Jewel points out in Of Muppets and Men, you don't want to do a joke on the Muppet Show unless it can only be done by Muppets. And so I can only assume that the powder puff that Timmy Monster wields is considerably larger than it would have been on Texaco Theater. The next time we have a segment we haven't talked about is, as I was mentioning, the backstage bit where Fozzie introduces the concept of hiding from Milton Berle. And it begins, like a lot of backstage bits, with the creatures from the previous sketch exiting. And this is all the monsters from It's Ugly filing past, with Kermit saying,
"Beautiful opening number, beautiful, very pretty."
Yeah, it's a good bit.
But then Fozzie brings up the idea of...
Yeah, Fozzie's hiding amongst trash bags? wearing a mask or something?
Yeah, I didn't see it as a trash bag. I assumed it was a cloak.
Oh, okay.
That it's a hood and cape. But yes, he's skulking like the Phantom of the Muppet Show in a cape and a mask, hoping to not be noticed. And sorry, Fozzie, that is the opposite of unobtrusive.
Well, I mean, he's probably hoping to be noticed but not recognized.
Mm.
But then Uncle Milty starts walking down the stairs, and so Fozzie runs away. But then Gonzo runs up to him and tells Uncle Milty to knock him dead. Milton Berle says, "Don't worry about the king."
And Gonzo says, "I'm not. I'm worried about you."
Yet again, 45 years prescient. How do they know we're going to have a king right now? They had a queen back then. But you can only be confused if there's a king. There wasn't a king.
You can keep on putting more icing on that bit, but I don't have anything in response. So I'm just waiting for you to be done so that we can move on.
Ben, king me.
It's good to be king.
I just can't wait to be king.
Charles had to.
Long time.
Long time. Kermit then goes to the curtain to introduce a person who's been around since the golden age of television. And here he is, the incomparable Dr. Julius Stageborg. Milton Berle.
He's not introduced that way, for those of you who don't watch the episode.
Milton is then gets about a line and a half out.
About as much as Fozzie ever does.
Before Statler and Waldorf begin heckling him.
You know what? I've what? Just figured out your style.
Really?
You work like Gregory Peck.
Gregory Peck's not a comedian.
Well,
I thought this was great
because
I often have issues with comedians just doing their act on The Muppet Show. And before we talked about that, Milton came in with these jokes ready to go. I knew he obviously had a hand in it, but I thought it took a lot of guts for someone of his stature to lose.
Yeah, essentially,
he never gets the upper hand on Statler and Waldorf.
The engine of this is not especially complimentary to Milton in that he isn't able to do his bit. He's owned. He's irritated. He's defeated.
The audience turns on him and he turns on the audience.
Yeah.
At one point, he says, like, "Don't laugh at that. I'm the comedian," or something to that effect. It's really good.
Milton in the interview...
with the vampire?
In the interview with Larry Wilde, he talks fairly extensively about what he calls squelchers, which is how you respond to a heckler, that you have a joke ready to go in order to shut down what they're doing. And he says that in his box of, at that point, 2,500,000 jokes, he has about 150,000 squelchers. And so those are the ones that he's rattling off to Jerry Jewell and the other writers. Let's see if I can find a couple of the ones that he doesn't use. One of the segments is that Statler and Waldorf tell him that the problem is he's not funny because he's too close to the stage.
Mm-hmm.
He needs to move back. And they say, you know, "Well, how far would you like me to be?" And the line that they actually say is...
"Keep going until you get in your car and drive away," or something like that?
Correct.
I didn't expect that to be the punchline, the "why don't you get in your car?" I figured it was just going to be like, "Keep going, keep going. Isn't this far back enough for you?" And then be like, no, just go behind the curtain. And being like, that would be the way to end the sketch.
"If you don't stop heckling me, I'll have the usher take you out," Burl says. And Statler and Waldorf were to reply, "I don't go out with ushers."
But I liked their retort to that in the episode better when they say, like, "Oh, he's too busy keeping the audience in."
That's right.
That was such a good punchline.
Burl gets mad at them and says, you know, you guys should be ashamed of yourself. And the line in reply is, "I know, I'm hoping nobody saw us come in here." To which he says, "Well, if you don't keep quiet, I'll have you thrown out and you won't see the rest of the show." To which they say, "Don't do us any favors." I mean, the fact that he just had a stack of 3x5 cards with all of these, you can just picture him rattling them off, doing the voices, tossing the card. Must have been a magical experience to just watch him burn through his material and be like, you can use any or all of this.
Well, it can't be all because the episode runs for 27 minutes.
Right.
And you brought us 20 minutes of material. We have other things to do.
We're not going to do a radical episode of The Muppet Show where we introduce the guest and he just gets heckled for the entirety of the show. We'll go to the black, come back from the ad break, and he's still being chewed up by two old men in the
He's
park.
Now just sweatier. This was still going while you were
That's
away.
Right.
Fozzie wouldn't have had to hide because he would have known where he was the That's entire right. time.
Just would have heard him being run over.
Just would have heard the audience just saying, he's already dead. Eventually, Gonzo comes out to try and save the day.
He thinks.
Yeah.
It's gone terribly. These guys have been picking on me, insulting me ever since I started.
Well, can I help you out?
Please, huh?
Which way did you come in?
I would... Get that out of here.
Which is a good follow-up from the fact that Gonzo had basically thrown him under the bus backstage, that he's therefore also the capper on this.
Mm-hmm.
But Ed Gonzo's joke is good. But I do legitimately think it's an interesting choice for Milton to, and we'll get into this when he does his next act, downplay his persona and personality. It means that he's not doing the same thing consistently throughout the show.
Mm-hmm.
So that when he then does the final act, he's able to do perhaps what's expected of him. But because he swung away from it so much for the rest of the episode, doing what's expected feels like a height as opposed to a baseline.
Mm-hmm. And also, as you talked about in the Bernadette Peters episode last week, where that was a person on the show before their star really started rising,
mm-hmm.
he's coming at this as, I'm at the peak.
Yeah.
Instead of trying to raise my star even higher, I'm going to joke about how it's starting to fall, maybe.
He has the ability to, after such a long and varied career, not have to worry about protecting his persona.
Mm-hmm. It's a really fascinating situation.
The next bit before Milton comes back is we have another backstage bit of Fozzie hiding from Milton.
This happened right after Pigs in Space, and goes behind a door.
We've seen this door a couple times before in terms of it's potentially leads to the alleyway or some other part of backstage, and it has a sliding panel in it that has been used by Fozzie in order to spy on or overhear things that have been happening.
And so he raises the panel, starts talking through it, and then he accidentally lets the panel drop on his nose, just like what happens to Link in Pigs in Space.
At which point Kermit comes out and says, literally that, Fozzie, that joke won't work. We just did it in Pigs in Space.
I thought it was bad writing at first. And then when Kermit said that, it won me back so hard. I was so into it. Ben?
Yeah?
Is this a hit?
Oh, fascinating.
Because we said Link wasn't because no one did it to him. Fozzie does it to himself. But it's not intentional still.
My instinct is to count it as a hit.
Well, so far, my instincts were wrong. All episode.
So, and your instinct was to count it or not count it?
I just put a question mark on it. So I guess if I had a question, I didn't think it was a hit. So it must be. But I do think that Link is not.
Okay.
I'm okay with that. So that means...
And in the free marketplace of ideas that is Twitter, anyone can feel free to at you for it.
Please do. I never use Twitter.
Upon Fozzie's accidental self-inflicted nasal damage, we then have Rolf gently, musingly playing Scott Joplin's The Entertainer. The camera pans back in order to reveal Milton at the piano, talking to him about the origins of the song and the fact that it, despite the fact that most people don't know this, actually has lyrics, which he then speak chants along to Rolf playing it.
Then other Muppets eventually join in.
Including a dancer, a ringmaster, a clown puppet that I've never seen before but was fascinated by, Lydia the Tattooed Pig, a pig acrobat, and Scooter and Fozzie.
So Fozzie, despite being scared of Milton, will share the stage with him.
Which makes the later things where Fozzie goes back to being, I can't talk to Milton Berle, completely breaks it.
Yep.
I was very irritated that there was no acknowledgement of this.
Ready for my justification?
Yeah, hit me.
Being in the act doesn't necessarily mean he needs to meet him.
And if they had just spent a little bit of dialogue on that, if they had just had something along the lines of Kermit saying, "You were just on stage with him! What's the problem? Just say hello!" I would have forgiven everything.
Yeah.
But instead, they just do the, "You can walk up and say hello." They say it twice, once before and once afterwards.
Fozzie, why don't you just go up to Milton Berle and introduce yourself?
Oh, I just couldn't do that, Scooter.
With no acknowledgement that they have just been interacting together.
I don't disagree with you. I'm just saying, if you share the stage with someone, you don't have to have met them.
I concur. However, while I am starting to get used to the idea that from episode to episode there is no continuity, I resist the idea that within an episode it is allowed to have no continuity.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you.
And after the chorus of circus performers jauntily sing the bridge, the atmosphere resets and the last verse is, again, talk sung by Milton, which made me wonder, did this former vaudeville performer not have the ability to sing?
He was put on this earth to bring us laughter and mirth. The entertainer, the star of the show.
And it's setting up a very subdued, melancholy mood, which I have sort of spoiled by talking about the last act swinging back up from this, but watching this, I was genuinely surprised and concerned as to what was going on.
Yeah.
Was this going to be a weird nostalgia bummer of an episode where famed comic and raconteur Milton Berle comes on to then just wistfully think of, is this going to be the American equivalent of an all music hall episode?
It was weird. It's definitely my least favorite bit of the episode. Not the whole episode because ugly song. But certainly the Milton Berle bits, this is the least entertaining of all of them.
I thought it was beautiful. I thought it was well shot. Mm-hmm. I thought that the puppets that were made for the circus group were very well made and interesting and designed. But it made me worried about the guests.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't dislike it.
But also, I'm about to get to the part that I think I like least.
Uh-oh.
Because at the end of this, there's the fade to black for commercial, and we come back for the UK spot, and Piggy says,
"Ralphie, would you play that song again for moi?"
Sure.
And then they do the entertainer again, except now they're not mournfully talk singing it. Piggy is singing it with an aggressively female set of pronouns and dancing along to it while Ralph sort of goes, "Yeah, get some."
The hog's really going wild or things like that.
And I did not understand the impulse to literally just do the song again.
Yeah, it was wild. But Piggy was so entertaining during it. Unlike the earlier version, which, like you said, is mournful, almost a funeral procession. This one, like, at one point, she starts playing the piano next to Ralph and, like, turns around and starts bashing her head against the keys while rolling around on it. It was so fun.
Okay, so why was this fun when Frank is effectively doing the same stuff that the belly dancer in the harem did during the performance of the Sheik of Araby?
It's not so chest heavy?
Because
cleavage heavy, specifically.
It's because Piggy is definitely shimmying and shaking her chest at the camera, and then she also doesn't
looks at it, like stares at it, which I did not like.
And then also gives us a moment where she's using her scarf to, in a fairly traditional British striptease way, show us her rump as she swings it back and forth.
I understood that's what they were going for, but it wasn't as overt as the Sheik. This, to me, was funny that it was trying to be sexy instead of trying to be sexy.
Mm. I agree that the way she interacts with the piano, the way her hair gets all mussed up.
She does the leg kick, which I always love the leg kick.
There's enough in there that is undermining her success at doing it. as opposed to in the previous episode, there was nothing in her performance particularly that made it seem funny, except for the fact that a lump of pressed felt isn't sexy.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, I can see that as a comic conceit. Of course, that was done later in production order.
Uh-huh.
So they took this idea and said, that was great, let's do it again.
But worse.
Yeah.
I think this would have been more successful if this UK spot happened in season 4.
Hmm.
And not been immediately after we had just heard that song for, let me check my notes, 2.7 minutes. And then heard it for another 1.87 minutes immediately after.
Well, this is the 45th anniversary of America not hearing this song. So it was very successful in that they didn't hear it for years later.
Until Nickelodeon aired these UK spots in the 90s.
Did they air this one?
Yes. Yes, they did.
Surprising. They also didn't have as much problem with it as we did with the Sheik.
However, the Muppet Newsflash was not aired on Nickelodeon. And the next scene that we're about to talk about was not aired on Nickelodeon.
Fascinating.
So yeah, again, I agree with you. In this episode, it's unnecessary, but I liked it. I just wish it wasn't in this episode.
There's a callback that we're going to talk about later in this episode that is unsuccessful as a callback. I think if they'd done this in season 4 of The Muppet Show, it would have also been just as unsuccessful as a callback to be like, oh, by the way, remember that thing that we did in
season
2?
See, I wouldn't have done that callback thing.
You
I would have
done
had
it as a sketch.
Yes, but having...
Just Piggy being like, entertainer should be about me instead of who it's originally about, and then being entertaining despite herself.
Yes.
As opposed to in the way in which she intended.
Instead of having essentially 5 minutes of straight of the entertainer. Yeah, that's too much the entertainer in a row.
Yes, definitely. The next bit, backstage, begins with Fozzie in a beard, fake nose and glasses, and to my eyes, lifts, which are never discussed.
Yeah, he's very tall. I noticed that too. I couldn't prove it, but he seems very tall in this.
At which point Scooter walks past.
He recognizes him immediately.
Fozzie is hoping that he's successfully in disguise because he says, well, what does it look like, small boy, I've never seen before? It's a great line. Combining exposition and joke in the same sentence. It's very quickly revealed by Scooter. He says, it looks like Fozzie is hiding from Milton Berle.
Fozzie walks away. Scooter runs up to him. Says some more things. I don't remember what they were.
Well, the thing is that Fozzie is worried about his ability as a comic next to Milton Berle. And Scooter is saying, you don't need to worry about that. He's so much funnier than you. At which point, Fozzie just breaks down and says, whatever happened to good old-fashioned lying? Then we have Zelda, and then we have another backstage moment. And this is where Kermit has been watching Zelda on stage, nodding appreciatively, and Fozzie reveals himself as having been hiding behind the backstage table by sneaking his head up above the lip and looking around suspiciously. This is where Kermit basically reiterates the dialogue that he and Fozzie had had while Fozzie was dressed up in the cloak and mask. Basically saying, you just should go up and say hi. And
this is your
saying,
last chance.
What would I say? Milton then does what we've been expecting the whole time, which is, while Fozzie is protesting, what would I say to him, shows up and quickly hides behind some baskets, which are just there.
Not Zach Galifianakis baskets. But like wicker baskets.
Although we did have a clown earlier.
It's true.
Which has some interesting depth of field in terms of Fozzie in the foreground, a layer of baskets, and then Milton and Kermit beyond that. And yet all in focus.
Yeah. And you see the back of Fozzie's head because he's obviously, I mean, he turns around to look at the audience, mm-hmm. but he's mostly trying to sneak peeks at what
they're also
doing.
Trying to keep the angle so that he can communicate with Kermit because Kermit has to lie for him because it turns out Milton wants to meet Fozzie.
Surprise, surprise.
And so Fozzie has to gesture wildly at Kermit, and Kermit then has to come up with something to say, no, he really, despite this new information, still doesn't want to meet his hero.
He's in Death Valley.
Death Valley?
Yep, Death Valley.
What's he doing in Death Valley?
Well, he's gathering material for his act.
I've seen his act. He can use it.
Until
Milton says he wants to do a song and dance with Fozzie.
At which point, Fozzie stands up and basically says, ta-da, I'm here.
Yeah. Oh, just got back from Death Valley.
Kermit exits as quickly as possible after this in order to not have to deal with the fallout of him just lying to the face of his guest star for a couple of sentences. And then they go back and forth with the concept of the phrase top banana, where Fozzie says, you know, I'll call you a banana if you want. I'll call you a Brussels sprout, a plum, whatever. He says, no, top banana is what they call the head comic during the days of burlesque. And then they start in a song called Top Banana. And then they take the first verse of that and go on stage continuing it, once again blurring the lines of what can be seen on stage and off stage, because for them to continue a song on stage implies the audience has seen the bit. Otherwise, they're just getting 2/3 of a song without its introduction.
Also, this happens instantaneously where Milton Berle backstage is wearing a full suit and on stage in the sketch is wearing a flannel and like a clown costume, basically.
He's got blacked out teeth in order to give himself extra buck teeth and a red nose and face paint and a massively appalling clashing plaid. Very clown.
This is great.
This is fantastic. This is from a 1952 Broadway musical that starred Phil Silvers. Lasted a fairly short run, but was then made into a movie of the same title, and it's a main number in that stage musical. There's a YouTube video of Phil Silver performing Top Banana in the film with a whole host of other comedians. How it's involved with the plot, you would need to watch the whole movie to see, instead of just this very low-res excerpt. Except that the bits that Milton is doing of carrying the case across the stage.
Hey, 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 where are you going?
I'm taking my case to court.
Are lifted directly from both, I assume, the musical and the film, because there's also a live appearance of the songwriter Johnny Mercer and a comedian named Rose Marie doing the same bit on a talk show and also doing the case carrying bit. So you've got Johnny Mercer and Phil Silvers and Milton Berle all doing the same transitional jokes. So he's not writing new jokes as part of the vaudeville bit. He's doing the exact routine that was canonized in 52.
Hey, hey, now where you going?
I'm taking my case to a higher court.
Wow.
See, that strikes me as anti everything that Milton Berle already talked about.
Well,
and the Muppet Show, saying we will only do things that only the Muppets can do.
Do you remember the SNL sketch with Joseph Gordon-Levitt where he does Make 'em Laugh?
Yes.
It's the equivalent of that. He's basically taking somebody else's routine and recreating it beat for beat on stage. In fact, as far as I can tell, there's only one rewriting in this song, which is
an actor has to bring on tears without a giggle.
A tough banana has to have 2 ears that wiggle.
One has to assume is not in the original Johnny Mercer lyrics.
Maybe that part's gonna make their ears wiggle.
Well,
although you said you watched it, so.
Well, I'm not convinced that the song is consistent in right. all versions of it.
True.
However, there is a published edition of the complete lyrics of Johnny Mercer, which was compiled in 2009. And a scan of Google Books has the lyrics on page 206. There also is listed at the end of those lyrics, additional lyrics from an early version of this script. So like any songwriter, there are things that made it to the final performance and things that were workshopped over time.
So in this recreation, is the shame moment recreated as well, where Milton doesn't want to do the last joke?
No.
Okay.
That is him bringing his take to it. So therefore, for him to do a bit in the lyrics where he's like,
stop the music. Do we have to do this joke?
You gotta do it.
It's an oldie, pal.
I know, do it.
You got a lot of guts, pal, I'll tell you that.
Where he's heightening the tension of the humor by advertising it's not going to be funny is very clever.
Something that I've done so many times.
So much of what he talks about to Joseph Bailey is about timing, and that you need to create space for the audience to recover from the previous laugh in order to be told another joke is coming. And so that's the other thing that this does, is it delays gratification.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of just doing a joke and then doing another joke, he does a joke and then they say, hey, we're about to do a joke. I'm not going to do it yet. All right, now I'm giving the introduction to the joke. So it sort of allows for a quiet and a breather before the next laugh comes.
Because he even asks, he says,
feed me once more, please. Feed me.
Hey, what happened in court?
Are you ready?
Yeah.
Which I loved that. Telling the audience, okay, ready? Here it comes. I was really confused by the way Milton, in the section between the second beat of the case joke and the third beat, they walk past each other and Fozzie says, Sam? And Milton goes, how did you know? How did you? And he like starts and stops it so many times.
How did you know?
Yes.
Folks, how'd you know my name was, will you wait till I tell it, folks, please? How'd you know my name was Sam?
That it's funny, but it also made me go, does he not remember what his next line is? Is he stalling for time? Is he doing this as a bit? It was very odd because there are a number of moments throughout this episode where you can kind of see Milton look off. Not like I mentioned earlier in the season where someone was probably looking at their cue cards or whatever. Don't remember who that was. Like,
oh,
yep, that sounds right. But like I've done in sketches before where it's like, oh, I know I have a line. What is it? And I like always look up, like I'm looking into my brain. And Milton does that throughout this episode and like takes these mini pauses that aren't imperceptible because I noticed them. And so I just wasn't sure whether this was one of those or completely scripted, and he's just doing a really good job at it.
Bailey's characterization of him in memoirs is that he's almost obsessive about timing.
Mm-hmm.
And the logical extension of that is that this is a man who's doing this deliberately in order to get or break a rhythm in order to establish a new rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
So he's doing something because he wants the beats to fall in a certain way in response to something in his head that says, this is how long this is supposed to go before the next laugh comes. Bailey tells an anecdote about, with the aspect of saying jokes to a laugh track, that there would be a recording light that, I want to get this right because I'm going to get it wrong otherwise. Milton went on to explain that in the early days when he worked live without a studio audience, the laugh track was laid in as the show was broadcast. Burl had a little flicker light installed on the front of the camera. When the laugh track ran, the light flickered. When Burl thought that the joke had run its course, he threw in a handle and the laugh track was faded out. The handle being the setup that allows him to say, I'm now resetting and I'm going to tell the next joke. So there was a give and take between the technician saying, we're running a laugh track here, and him then bringing in dialogue to tell them fade it out because now I want to reset. And he had in his head a tuned sense of how a live audience would laugh and therefore what the right timing would be.
Mm. Okay. It's still, I clocked it throughout the episode,
yep.
Those little moments, not this one. This one I totally believe is completely intentional. But those other moments, hearing that now, that may very well be what he's doing. But not knowing that beforehand, I was like, it seems like something's happening
yeah.
here.
And again, yes, you're right. You didn't have that information. I think reading that, that's what is the logical conclusion to come to.
Absolutely.
All of that presupposes it's successful.
Mm.
Because he's doing that without a working relationship with how the Muppet Show editors are going to lay in a laugh track or how we're going to laugh on it. So he has an internal clock on what he thinks is going to work. That doesn't mean it's not going to reveal itself as unsuccessful in the final cut.
Also, it's been
1 week
since you looked at me.
Literally.
Also true. Is this what it's like when it's not unusual, you?
That you lose track of your train of thought and have to start over?
It's not that I've lost track. I just want to get it out correctly.
Okay.
And then try and figure out how to say it a different way so that way you don't do it to me again, which I can't. And now I'm losing the track. Uh-oh. All I remember is that my sentence started with, it's been...
That's too bad, because now we can't cut this out, because you don't have the end to it. I was talking about timing and laugh tracks and recording
tracks.
Weather Day.
Yes, direct. Thank you. When Milton Berle was on his own TV show doing this action of controlling the laugh track or trying to influence the laugh track, it was 1948.
Mm-hmm.
It's now 1977. Audiences are different, too. So that also goes to what you're talking about of... maybe this isn't as successful anymore. He has it in his head that he knows better. But audiences are 30 years apart. So I still think it's successful. I think this was great. But I see what you're getting at. Also?
It's not unusual.
No. No. At the end of the sketch, Milton hits Fozzie with his hat and himself with his hat for two more hits.
Then we have the curtain call where Fozzie and Milton come out together after Kermit says we'd like to thank our guest, and Kermit is a little PO'd that Fozzie is coming out with him and says, what are you doing here?
They're best friends now.
Now on, it's going to be the bear and the Burl, Fozzie claims.
And Milton corrects him, says wrong, it's the Burl and the bear.
At which point Fozzie says, yes sir, grovel, grovel. And Burl says, don't you forget that, grovel, grovel. This is a callback. Because at the very beginning, the first introduction of the concept of Fozzie not wanting to talk to Milton, he says, I couldn't just say hello, I'd have to make a speech and grovel. And it's a totally failed callback because there's no middle in this three that makes us remember that that's part of the bit.
Hey, Ben, maybe there was. Maybe there was a second reference to groveling. And that's where the line justifying them sharing the stage together was.
Or maybe it was when Milton was supposed to go back and back and back all the way out to the car, which was on a gravel driveway.
Oof. Oof. Love it. Very good.
And that's the end of The Muppet Show.
Mm-hmm. Ben, I have some statistics for you.
Please.
There aren't any explosions. There are no Muppet human kisses, so there's just 6 hits. In terms of music, what's your impression of music on this episode?
Not talking about quality.
Yes. Quantity only. Oh, actually, let's go back for a minute.
Yeah.
Because earlier in the episode, you mentioned in The Entertainer, he doesn't sing very well.
Mm-hmm.
And it caused you to think, what's going on?
Maybe he's not much of a singer, but then he sings
so well,
Top Banana.
And so good.
Yeah. And is able to transition between singing with Fozzie and delivering jokes with nary a hitch. He doesn't have to switch anything about his voice to go from, I'm just telling you a joke, see, to,
if you want to be a top banana, you gotta start from the bottom.
So great.
Which doesn't surprise me for a man that was raised in vaudeville.
Yeah.
But had surprised me as to why he was hiding his light under a bushel during The Entertainer.
That jump surprised me in Top Banana, and I think helped me like Top Banana all that much more. Because as it started to go, I went, uh-oh. And then he did great, and I was like, oh, good.
Yeah, it's all about delayed and diminished expectations, that he's creating a sense of low-key anti his persona leading up to this point, so that it's this explosion of joy at the end where he's doing all the things.
Mm-hmm. So, now going back to statistics, quantity-wise, what do you think?
Well, the answer is either it's the new lowest amount, or it's just above our previous one but didn't quite edge it out. But I'm going to go with A.
That was my thought, too, as I did it, as I was tallying things up, because there are so few numbers
right
in this episode. But as I alluded to with there's 5 minutes of The Entertainer, they're all long. Ugly Song is 2.7 minutes. The Entertainer is 2.7 minutes.
Which one?
The first one. The UK Entertainer is 1.87 minutes.
Yeah, those are usually under two.
Yeah. Top Banana, there's a break in the music.
Okay.
So I have two sections for that. The first section from backstage it to where he
says,
stop the music. Yep. So I stop the clock. That was 2.43 minutes and then another 0.63 minutes at the end.
Zelda is under 2 minutes as well?
Zelda is under 1 minute.
Huh.
It's 0.87 seconds. Keep doing that. 0.87 minutes.
Julius!
I have trouble with those little decimals.
Yeah, there's not a lot of musical numbers, but they're all long. So it's 13 minutes, 29 seconds out of 26 minutes, 24 seconds. So for the second time this season, we're over the 50% threshold.
Wow.
Yeah, I wouldn't have thought that.
But that also makes a certain amount of sense. I keep track of the number of segments.
There's not a lot of segments in
there. That's right. We're normal average is 24 to 25. I've got 21 for this episode.
Yeah, and I didn't time it because it's not music, but the heckler section.
It's long.
Yeah, had to have been the bulk of this episode. The longest thing, easily.
Yep.
So yeah, 51.1% music. And last week's episode was 55.05. Second longest amount of music and second highest percentage of music this season. As for ranking, I talked about how much I liked Milton Berle.
Mm-hmm.
Put him in at number 4, just above Dom DeLuise at 5. Except for The Entertainer, which I thought was fine. Loved the Statler and Waldorf bit. Loved Top Banana. Thought his interactions with all the Muppets in things other than The Entertainer when he was backstage were great. He didn't just do his act, even though he did just do his act, but he didn't do what I would have expected him to do. So, yeah, he ranked very high.
Also, he just did Phil Silver's act.
True, but I didn't know that at the time.
So he very much definitely didn't just do his act.
True, very true. And I don't like that. I'm not going to drop him because I still enjoyed it, but I don't like
Milton
it.
Milton did a very good cover band.
Yeah, and then did not credit his sources.
Well, as always, we end each episode by talking about our 5 favorite moments of the show. A moment is not a full sketch, but it's a piece of production, of script writing, or a soupçon of inflection or delivery that we want to highlight. And Pete, why don't you start this week?
For my first moment, our first moment of the episode, since I just talked about statistics, I'm going to talk about statistics a little bit more.
Okay.
More specifically, timing. And
you know what the secret to comedy is, right?
Timing. I want you to leave all that pause in. Wanted it to go on longer, but was afraid you'd cut even more of it out.
All right.
Anyway, so I'm going to talk about Pigs in Space. Strange Pork cuts his prediction down from 17 hours to 17 seconds.
Mm.
And if you're going to mention time to me, I'm going to track it.
Because you love time.
And timing. So
you're a timekeeper.
I am. TikTok. So I started the clock as soon as Strange Pork said collision at 17 seconds.
Mm.
And that was 11 minutes and 50 seconds into the episode. Gonzo swerves his motorcycle and the camera cuts back to the crew at 12 minutes and 6 seconds. 16 seconds after it. So if he didn't swerve, it would have been 17 seconds. For the first time, the Muppet Show got it right. So that's my first moment.
Very impressive. For the second moment, my first moment, I'd like to talk about the successful yes-anding of Death Valley. That as much as Kermit hated lying to Melton Berle, and as much as I hate the sitcom trope of coming up with a ridiculously unrealistic lie that you then have to explain your way out of, I love the fact that when Fozzie abandons all pretense of having been in Death Valley, a thing that Kermit just had to make up off the top of his head, and pops up from behind the baskets, Kermit continues the bit. Kermit says,
Fozzie, back so soon?
Yes, Kermit.
How was Death Valley?
Hot. Hot, and that's funny. Nope. Too hot to be funny in Death Valley.
Which is funny. So he must have been in a damn cold climate in that stage, because that was incredibly efficient and effective at getting to the end of that and being able to move on, of wrapping up that yes and in a little bow, but at the same time also not throwing Kermit under the bus, not throwing himself under the bus, just being like, we are going to acknowledge that this is ludicrous and then move on as quickly as possible. And I think if they had wanted to do a callback instead of grovel, grovel at the end, if they had said something about Death Valley, that would have been my 45 years punch up, is that would have been a stronger callback than the one they went with. That said, loved it.
Speaking of callbacks, for my second moment, our third moment, I'm going to talk about something we already talked about, which is Gonzo saving Milton Berle at the end of the heckling segment.
Yeah.
I don't think I realized the joke the first time I watched it.
Yes.
I got that it was trying to be a joke, but I don't think I got the joke. And the second time, I got the joke and was laughing so hard at it. Dave's performance of Which Way Did You Come In? It's so innocent.
I think that's part of why it's easy not to get that it's a joke, that it's a pun. Gonzo delivers it with such barefaced naivete that it almost feels like a non sequitur as opposed to him playing on words.
Yeah, like Gonzo doesn't realize it's a joke. He does.
Yeah.
But
it's definitely played in such a, we're not acknowledging that this is a punchline way.
It was great. And it destroyed me once I realized it was a joke.
For my last moment ever, I'm not doing any more moments. This is it. This is done. We're done. Forget it.
So I'm going to have to do all five moments from now on?
Yeah.
Oh, that's going to be rough.
I'd like to talk about the singing owl.
The Furby.
I'd like to talk about the winged Furby. The Pegasus of Furbies. I don't know why Jerry Nelson chooses to puppeteer the owl as falling asleep in between who's, but it's really funny.
Mm-hmm.
And we've talked a lot in this episode about timing and the amount of careful movement that you have to do in order to have those very Furby eyelids droop closed in order to then spring back open for him to say, "Woo," one more time. I was riveted. Like, I was just watching this bird fall asleep. I have no idea what the lyrics to this song are, because as much as I think our guest ignored puppeteer, our failed audition, has a great voice and does a really good job, does an equally good job when she's singing in The Entertainer, Nelson steals the absolute show by doing a wholly unnecessary and perfectly pitched performance.
For my final moment, our final moment of this episode.
Your first of all the rest of the moments.
First moment of the rest of my life. I'm going to talk one last time about Top Banana.
Hey, yes.
We talked about it briefly when Milton Berle doesn't want to do the final bit. And Fozzie has to talk him into it. So Milton does the joke. He says, I lost the suit. And then Fozzie covers his eyes in shame. When he was the one who convinced Milton to do the bad joke, he's then ashamed that he did it. And it made me laugh really hard. And he's like, oh no, you gotta tell this joke. Oh no, that was a bad joke. We shouldn't have done that. Great job, Frank. This episode of The Henson Perspective was researched, performed, and edited by Ben Russell and Pete Russell. Sound design such as it is, also by the two of us.
Our logo is based on designs by Liana Emily. Thank you, Liana. Music in the episode comes from archive.org and archival Henson Associate clips of Silver and Cone's Yes, We Have No Bananas, under what we hope is transformative fair use, much as the Hensons did when they first broadcast to Sam and Friends.
You can find us at farstperspective.com and follow us on Twitter at @FarstNameBasis. This podcast, as conceived of by Nathan Emily and Ben Russell, is an intellectual exploration of the lasting power of comedic phenomena.
All excerpts in this podcast are used for the purposes of review. If there are things, dates, facts, names, heckler, alts, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect, please contact us via the website and we will post it to our errata page on farstperspective.com as soon as possible.
Again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Pete, my co-host is Ben.
Timing.
And we'll see you next week when we discuss Season 2, Production Episode 22, guest starring Teresa Brewer. Yay!